Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio. I am going to bring on something more fun, a little bit less stressful. With all the politics going on and just the world being in a hard place, I am bringing on someone who had 50 jobs in 50 states, and he went around, found jobs, worked odd jobs, tried to find jobs that reflected the state, and that's what he did. And he got all sorts of lessons out of this. He was a college kid, couldn't find a job, and then ended up doing this and ended up learning things that he never thought he would learn, opening up his mind. His name is Daniel Siddiqui, and he's going to join the program pretty soon. And after we have that, I have Albert Abel come onto the show, and he's going to talk about zero point energy. This is a show that I did a while ago, but I want to replay it because I love this episode. He explains what zero point energy is, how it works, how they invented it at the University of Colorado. Well, they found it. It's always been around, right? They figured out how to do it at the University of Colorado, and they patented it there. They have an amazing physics program at the University of Colorado, and MIT has been doing work with this stuff. It's real, and he explains how it works, and they're working on doing endless batteries. And if we don't do it, the Chinese, the Russians, somebody's going to do it before us. I actually think that we already have this technology, but now we have people in the society who's working on it and developing it and bringing it to the people manufacturing it and have figured it out. I'm excited to play this interview again, but let's first do Daniel Siddiqui and his 50 states and 50 jobs.
Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, well, I've been covering such heavy issues lately, and I'm like, this is really interesting. I'm going to talk to him and do something that's really fun and talk to you about your adventure. You decided to go to take 50 jobs in 50 states. Why? What happened there?
Well, I would say it was a form of desperation because after college graduation, reality hit me where I could not find a single job. I went on nearly 120 rounds of job interviews and did not get a single offer. And I felt maybe I was ill prepared and I wasn't career ready. But being invited for multiple rounds for one position shows that I at least had the skill set or the credentials that were necessary. But I just never got my break.
So what was your degree in? What were you trying to do?
I studied economics, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with it. It's kind of one of those kind of open-ended majors. You just don't know which direction. That there's no clear direction is what I'm trying to say. And, I was trying to work for banks, do marketing, accounting. I really chose the major for all the wrong reasons. It was because it was just an avenue of familiarity because of I already had exposure through family in the business world and
sure.
Entrepreneurship and investment banking. But it wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do. But, in college, you have to think strategically what's going to help you get a job and set yourself up for independence after you graduate. But, it looked like it didn't work for me. So, I was desperate for an opportunity after 3 years of looking. And then I also would attribute curiosity as well, because I've always been a curious person and wondered how things were and how life was outside of my bubble. And it was kind of the combination of desperation and curiosity that led to the idea of wanting to explore the world around me, which I knew little about, or in this case, America. I mean, my own country, I didn't know much about besides my own environment.
Well, I think that's the case with a lot of people, right? We're in our own little bubbles and you don't know really the country that you live in. So
And I'm finding that to be more the case, throughout this political campaign. Is just we're all, and as I travel, I mean, I've been to all 50 states nearly five times now, and people truly live in their bubble. And even when I went to Long Island and gave a presentation to a community college, asked how many people have been to New York City, and not many people raised their hand, and that was shocking to me. So,
travel when they live in New York. They don't go to the city. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a lot to have to do with the lack of curiosity and maybe independence as well, because usually you want to go out and explore with people. And if you can't find people to tag along with, or have people tag along with you, you're going to feel stuck and not end up doing anything. So,
well, since people are in their bubbles, what did you find? You know, you're in your own bubble, and then you go around and you get into other people's bubbles. What were you learning? What did you see? Was there big differences in, the coasts and the middle of the country? And then was there differences in the middle of the country between the different states?
Yeah, I feel like we're very different. I feel like there's more differences than similarities. The environment truly shapes what you experience and your views. And that's why I really encourage students, when I give presentations, really go out and explore the world outside of your own and broaden your perspective and make and develop informed views, rather than, labeling people and stereotyping people. I mean, a lot of the stereotypes that I grew up to learn or debunked when I traveled. I mean, for instance, I was working with the Amish community building furniture, and I thought that would have been the most impossible experience, because I thought they were going to be very closed-minded or just kind of a closed community. But they were just as open as anybody else that I worked and lived alongside of.
Yeah, they just have different views on how they want to live their life.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I respect the differences that we all have, and I don't ever expect to change people. So just accept people the way they are and embrace our differences is kind of what I learned.
Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Bay Area of California. And,
okay, so it's pretty liberal out there, right, compared to the rest of the country?
Yeah, I would say so, and very diverse. And diversity, in my mind, it only works if you have a common goal, work together rather than, isolating yourself. But I feel like most of the middle of the country probably doesn't embrace diversity, because they feel like people that do move in are not assimilating, so they're just creating their own communities and becoming isolated. So I find that even in the workplace, not just in just the way of life and the culture, but even at the workplace.
So was there any place that you went to that you just couldn't stand the culture and the, yeah. What did you have a hard time with?
I had a hard time on each of them, to be honest with you. I was an outsider really going in, but, and as I was growing confidence and becoming more adaptable, it became easier. And actually, I started to find it more fascinating. It made the travel more interesting to see that this is, the same country. And we're living differently. And we all have different things that motivate us, and levels of ambition, and things that get us excited to wake up in the morning. These were things that made the journey awesome. And I want to just share with your listeners some of the jobs that I did.
Oh, absolutely.
I got a chance to log with in Oregon. I worked on a lobster boat in Maine. I made cheese in Wisconsin. I worked on a border patrol in Arizona. I worked on a meatpacking plant in Kansas, a boiler maker in Missouri. I worked as a high school football coach in Alabama. Coal mine in West Virginia. Those are all the labor intensive blue collar jobs that I worked. And then I got a chance to be a weatherman for NBC in Ohio, in Cleveland. I was a dietitian, or worked alongside of a dietitian, in Mississippi. Did some science jobs, like marine biology in Washington, agronomy, studying soil in Iowa, and then hydrology in Colorado, studying the rivers.
That's incredible. So was
where
it easier to
live now,
was it
so.
Easier to get jobs after a while? Because then they realized what you were doing, and they're like, "Oh, this is really neat." And it became easier, or what?
No, it was never easy because all the industries were different, and I came in with no experience on most of them. I was very focused on what I wanted to experience. For instance, jobs that reflect the economy and the culture of each state. And so, you know, I had a lot of people reaching out to me, "Oh, you're doing a cool journey. Do you want to do this?" But it had nothing to do with my mission. You know, the jobs that I landed, like for instance, working on a lobster boat in Maine, I didn't know how to contact lobstermen directly. So I had to just be resourceful, and I called up grocery stores and asked for connections through them. And, you know, same with Amish, you know, I called up furniture outlets and how can I get in contact with. So it was never easy. A lot of people didn't know of my journey and what I was doing that were a part of the experience. And I saw him on CNN. Yeah, we'd like to hire you because of that. I would turn them down if they weren't hiring me because of the authentic experience or the organic experience, then I would have turned them down. So,
what did you get paid in each place that you were at?
Yeah, so I got paid 45 jobs out of the 50, and all the jobs were from a Monday through a Saturday typically, and you know, it ranged. My wages ranged, of course. I expected whatever you know, anyone else that was in that position would earn. So nothing more, nothing less.
Even though you didn't know what you were doing.
I went through nearly 5,000 no's, about 100 per state. And rejection is a huge part of my story. And the 50 employers that said yes, they took a risk. And they hired me, and they embraced this experience, and they trained me well. You know, they threw me into the fire and made me learn by doing. And that's why I really encourage people to get out of their element and challenge themselves by being out of their element. This is the quickest and the best, most effective way of learning.
So what were you surprised by during this whole process?
Oh, I mean, everything. I mean, even host families. I was expecting to sleep in the back of my Jeep Cherokee the entire trip, but I found a host family in every state just by happenstance. You know, when I was at a job site, people would ask me, "Oh, where are you staying while you're in this state?" And I didn't want to admit I was planning to sleep in my car, you know, but they offered me a place, you know, and that happened in every single state. And that was one of the most eye-opening, is just the willingness of people to help you. And networking became a huge part of this journey. I would say a majority of my jobs were found through meeting people, obviously with the host families as well. I mean, you really show that you help yourself, and then I think it's just naturally people feel that they want to jump on board to support you. And that's another thing I want to encourage students to do when they're looking for jobs, or just anybody looking for jobs, is showing that you're passionate, you have enthusiasm, and then I think that just becomes a natural element of getting opportunities from people.
Well, you know, with the election going on, how do you see the parallels of what you learn through what you're seeing now with the extreme social situations we're seeing now with politics?
Well, I mean, it's just like your job. You choose jobs because when I did a poll when I was traveling across the country, 52% of people choose their job because of their environment, because of what they've seen in their past, what they've been exposed to. And I think the same thing is aligns with your political views, is you develop views on the people around you, and you see how different people are based on the regions that they live in. And that's why I encourage, I don't really feel, you know, in my heart that anybody has a wrong viewpoint. I just feel it's just different, and we need to understand the way, the why they feel that way. I mean, it's all justified to me because I lived in all sorts of communities, you know, from Appalachia region to I even got a chance to live for a month on a Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And you really see the effects of political decisions and the economy and how economy and unemployment or underemployment can affect people socially as well.
Well, do you think that, you know, the liberals are always viewed as being much more open and accepting, but what we're seeing now is that they're not being accepting.
Open.
Yeah.
They only accept if it you know, helps their you know, what I'm trying to say, as long as it's to their advantage.
It's so pretty that, surprising. It's almost like people are afraid to even talk to them because they won't accept their views.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you see that when you were traveling around as well? That,
you know, I was, when I did this journey, it was right when President Obama was elected. So I didn't really, I was still more focused on the economics of each of the states and all that, and so busy with learning about people and culture. But, you know, the political thing is something I never really, you know, got involved in. But now it's becoming more interesting to me, because I do understand where people are coming from. And actually, my next project is to do 50. I'm calling it American Bucket List Challenge, where I experience 50 unique cultures in 50 states. So I'm gonna get a chance to really dive into, you know, just like, for instance, I'm gonna be singing with the Tabernacle Choir in Utah, and doing a buffalo roundup on horseback in South Dakota. So I want to really immerse in more of the culture rather than the jobs this time, and really encourage people to get out of their bubble, because we all live differently. There's some historic context on each of these things. I think the best way to learn about people and the culture is through hobbies or pastimes, and that's essentially what I'm planning to do. And I want to just encourage people to just inform themselves.
Well, so how are you funding this? Are you getting paid once you're done with this? Are you making money through writing a book and doing talks and things, or?
Well, no, I kind of subsidize these projects with, yeah, books and talks. But I mean, my primary focus and career is an internship program that I run, and it's growing pretty rapidly. I mean, on 80 college campuses now, where students could experience 5 jobs in 5 states in 5 weeks.
Oh, excellent. And earn
college credit for it. And it could be related to their career, their major, or if they're undeclared, then they have a chance to experience 5 unique jobs. And we place them there. And I gained a lot of life experience and confidence and information. And I learned a lot in just 1 year. And I wanted to create a platform for college students to have a similar type of experience, to get out of the classroom environment and really connect the dots with the real world, because we find a lot of students just go through the motions and not really sure where this could lead, where their education could lead or help them. And there was a time I questioned the value of college education, just because I was wondering, how is this going to benefit me? How am I going to utilize it? You know, all these questions were going on. When it was too late, you know, I was thinking about these things too late. And so I just want to prepare kids or college students early on thinking about career, because why do you go to college? Is to set yourself up for a good career, a meaningful job, not just to get a stamp on your resume, you know. So
you're in 80 colleges and universities. Is it all over the country?
All over. I mean, I might even I'm hoping to expand it finally in my home state of California. Stanford University, UC Berkeley, they've all expressed huge interest. And but yeah, I'm all over the SUNY schools, State University of New York system.
How about University of Minnesota?
Yeah, at Duluth. I'm on the Duluth campus there. Yeah.
No, you should
Are
get
you from
to Twin Cities. I teach at the U of M.
Oh, do you? Okay. Yeah, I mean I would love to get it all on the UM campuses, definitely.
Interesting. And how many people do you have working in your company?
There's four of us now, and we're expanding quickly, you know.
I imagine. See, you weren't supposed to just go get a job. You were supposed to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah, see, that's that was one of the big questions after I finished my 50th job. What am I going to do next? And I wanted to not just settle for a job that I got offered in, because 48 out of the 50 jobs offered me a full-time job at the end of each week. And
You're
I
a good
said,
worker. Good for you. Keep
well,
going.
I think a lot of it had to do just with attitude and willingness to learn, and the employers and coworkers really appreciated that. But I thought I could do something bigger. I thought I could do something bigger with what I experienced and solve a problem. And I knew there was a problem. When I was a college student, I was like, I was just a common, I went through everything that most common college students go through, and just wondering, what am I going to do with my major, and how can I find an opportunity, and how can I find a job that I love? I mean, we find that nearly 90% of Americans don't like what they do. And I just want to encourage, the students to take risks and learn to be adaptable, because there's too many options and avenues out there to take advantage of. And unless you're adaptable and open-minded, you're going to be closing a lot of doors. And there's also too much rejection that people are fearing. And that's closing a lot of doors too, because I found that rejection and embracing rejection opens doors, because if you just have a high level of tolerance, then you're finally going to get a break. And so I created a business that I felt was necessary, and that's why I think it's growing.
That's excellent. You're having just the right attitude and not being in your bubble, reaching out, not being afraid. That's just so great. You exemplify what all these lessons are that we're trying to teach kids. That's great. So now when you're getting out of your bubble and people getting out of your bubble, that's when you grow, isn't it?
Yeah, it's challenge. I mean, it's challenging. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But there's comes to it comes to a point where you start getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I would say the first job was it was the first time leaving my comfort zone. It was tough because I had my parents saying, "We'll see you in 3 weeks." They totally didn't believe I was going to pull this off. They thought it was impossible. How is he going to find 50 jobs when he can't find one? How is he going to,
You proved everybody wrong. That's funny. You
and
can't
also
find
how
one. How can you find 50? That's awesome.
And how is he going to afford this financially? How is he going to handle, just being on the road on your own? Loneliness, the emotions of that was very tough. But I would say once I was able to press through that threshold, I realized it was all control in my mind. Once I was able to control my emotions, things started to fall into place. It's that fear that you need to get over. It's really not that bad as you imagine it. So,
And your cultural journey that you're going to do 50, you're going to do another 50 cultures in 50 states. Is that your plan, or is it just 50 different cultures? Okay.
no, all 50 states. Yeah. So Minnesota, it's lakes. The lakes are a big part of the culture, and water skiing was invented there. So I'd probably be water skiing for the first time. I'm calling it American Bucket List Challenge, as I mentioned. And I want them to be. I want to encourage other people to do this journey as well. So I want to make it fun also and challenging. So,
Okay, so where can universities get hold of you, and where can other people get hold of you to learn about this? Because you have an amazing program for universities, and then people just want to know more about you as well.
I have a website called Living the Map, and that's exactly what I did. Living the Map, and. You can find my contact and more about our programs on that site.
Okay, so you have all the university contacts there, and then people too, if they want their kids or themselves to go to, no, do they have to be affiliated with the university to be able to go through your internship program?
Not necessarily. That would be a huge plus because they can get awarded credits. But yeah, they could do it unaffiliated if they desire.
Well, let's say their university isn't set up yet, but they really want to
Yeah.
do it. Okay.
Yeah, then they could. Yeah, then they could still do it, and probably go back to their college and ask a faculty member if they could get credit for it.
Oh, excellent! So you get credits. Kids get they go to five different states, five jobs, and then they get class credits for this.
Absolutely. Yep.
Oh, everybody would want to do that. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this program, and keep doing your thing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Sarah. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm going to have all of Daniel's information up on my webpage at sarahwestall.com. If you or your child wants to do an internship, five states and five jobs, I think that's a wonderful idea. He says he has 80, 90 universities that are affiliated with his internship program now. So I will have all that information up on my webpage. But now we're going to move on to Zero Point Energy, which is an amazing topic, because this is, I believe, this is the energy that we are going to be using into the future. There are other sorts of energy as well that's free energy. This will be able to power everything that we have without hurting the environment, without costing us after the initial investment. Not even just that, I want something for my laptop so my laptop doesn't have to be plugged in every second, or my battery with my cell phone that doesn't work anymore, so now I have to go get it replaced. There's some issues with bringing it to market because of the petrodollar and doing it in a way that's not disruptive to our geopolitical monetary system. And I suppose we have to be responsible for how we bring things and not be so disruptive that it actually destroys us versus help us. So I really, really respect that. But at the same time, let's figure out how to get it out there, because it's absolutely great, and I think it can do great things for many people. So let's welcome Albert Abel to the program.
Hi, Al. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. How are you today?
I'm doing great. And I have been really excited about this interview. You have a really, really interesting thing going on there. And, well, you claim, let's get right into this. You claim to have the ability to create a device which requires no fuel, produces no waste, and supplies unlimited and continuous clean, safe, and affordable energy. How is that even possible?
You know, sir, that has been a point of contention ever since I came up with that phrase. In our business plan, I opened the plan by saying, imagine a device that requires no fuel, produces no waste, and yet produces clean, safe, affordable energy. And every time people would read that, they said, this sounds like perpetual motion, free energy, or too good to be true. And quite frankly, that was a little frustrating, because what I had to point out to people is, hey, I'm not the first person to do this. Jovian is not the first company to do this. What I described in that definition is, in fact, a technology which currently exists. It's currently a $500+ million a year business, and it's headed well up to $4 billion dollars a year by the end of the decade. This is an industry and a technology that's known as energy harvesting.
Okay, well, what is energy harvesting?
Energy harvesting is the process of capturing small amounts of waste ambient energy for low energy applications. Things like piezoelectric, thermoelectric, photoelectric, triboelectric, other processes are used to capture and utilize ordinary but wasted energy.
Would it also be solar?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. If you think in terms of a few years back when people used to wear watches, and one of the new crazes was the self-winding watch, and the watch actually gained its energy to wind itself from the movement of the wearer's wrist. And this was a form, an early form of energy harvesting.
Okay, so why, if these devices exist, I know solar devices are starting to be used, you know, in mass, but why aren't people doing more stuff with solar or with energy harvesting?
Sarah, energy harvesting is probably it's kind of the great waking giant that is going to be shaking the foundations of a lot of commerce over the next decade or two. Energy harvesting is a big, big business, and it's growing at a rate that is much faster than most people can even imagine. It's being applied to sensors for remote locations, things like measuring the stresses in aircraft skin, pretty much any place where you need to get some sort of tiny amount of electricity to do a very small job. They're placing energy harvesting devices. They're even putting these in people's bodies so that they can use their heartbeat to power their pacemaker.
And so it's pretty much small quantities, stuff that are when you're doing something that doesn't need mass energy.
Most energy harvesting, but by no means all energy harvesting, but most energy harvesting, yes, is focused on ambient waste energy that is available in little tiny amounts and can only be sucked up in little tiny amounts. But as you pointed out, solar energy is an example where massive amounts of energy can be captured. And once you have a solar operation in place, that sits around and basically produces prodigious amounts of energy all the period that the sun is actually shining, and it is energy that requires no fuel, produces no waste, and yet it does produce tremendous amounts of energy, and it's clean and it's safe.
Well, but you believe you have maybe a new and improved way of getting to harvesting energy, and you are using the quantum vacuum field. What is that?
This is something that I am tremendously excited about. We're not doing anything unique in terms of the concept of energy harvesting. What is unique at Jovian is that we are focused on a totally novel source of energy, a source of energy which modern physics accepts and knows and understands exists. But up until this point, modern physics has held the position that it's not possible to directly extract this energy for practical use. The quantum vacuum field is often referred to as the zero point field or zero point energy or vacuum energy. And it's the ubiquitous universal underlying background field of electromagnetic energy, which exists at the lowest possible energy state that a quantum vacuum mechanical system can exist at, the so-called ground state. In other words, if you think in terms of a pet clock pendulum that swings until it appears to finally stop, in quantum physics, it never really stops. There is always a motion there, and this is well understood within quantum physics, but that motion is always there, and at its lowest level, this is what's known as the background field of the zero-point field. And in fact, it's called the zero-point field, but it isn't in fact truly zero-point. There is always still a minute amount of energy. But it's so low that physicists would tell you that it is not possible to directly capture this energy and utilize this energy because it's already at its lowest ground state. Imagine a waterfall that has a 100-foot drop, a lot of energy. Imagine a waterfall that has a quarter-inch drop, almost no energy. Certainly nothing that would be practical to capture. So what Jovian has found a unique backdoor approach whereby we, rather than extracting this energy from the quantum vacuum field directly, we believe that we are capable of extracting this energy indirectly because of a rather unique interaction between the quantum vacuum field and ordinary matter.
Well, and how do you do that?
You're
that talking to an ignoramus, so... Even though I have an engineering background, I feel like some of this is going over my head. So I'm sure it's going over other people's heads as well. So explain it as if I'm a three-year-old. No, not a three-year-old. A third grader. Let's go with third grader.
I think we can do that very simply. I don't talk to ignoramuses very often, and I know I'm not talking to one now.
I think our listeners are more a little more... they're smart. They're smarter than the average bear. They're not out there watching reality TV and things. They're listening to this, so they're pretty smart. So you can explain it maybe a little bit above a third grader, but maybe not too much.
Okay. Well, if you think in terms of a conventional model of the atom and the electron orbiting around the nucleus of the atom, Think of that electron that's orbiting as containing a level of energy, which it does. In fact, if that electron is excited to a higher energy and then is allowed to drop back down into the lower energy state, it throws off a packet of light called a photon. And this is precisely the same principle that an LED light operates on. On an LED light, the electrons are excited by the electrical voltage, and the electron jumps to a higher orbital. When it drops from that higher orbital to a lower orbital, it releases a photon or a packet or bundle of light. And that light can be captured as either visible light, can be captured by photovoltaics, that is solar cells, or it can be released as light in the infrared frequencies, which means that it can be captured as heat. Now, what we are doing is basically the same thing. When an atom is passed within a very tiny cavity called a Casimir cavity, that atom is momentarily excluded from the energy of what's known as the quantum vacuum field. And there are some very good reasons for this, but I won't go into that amount of detail. But think in terms of an automobile driving down the highway, you're listening to the radio, and you come to a tunnel. And when you go into the tunnel, the signal from the radio station outside is blocked because of the tunnel. And when that happens, what happens to your radio? You lose the station. When you lose the station, you're out of music. But when you emerge from the tunnel, suddenly you're exposed to that energy from the broadcast tower, your radio station comes back, and your music resumes. And what we are doing in the Jovian process, we are basically allowing atoms to go into a tunnel. And in that tunnel, they are momentarily shielded from the energy of the quantum vacuum field at specific frequencies. And what that does is that causes the electron to lose orbital energy. And when it does, it throws off a photon. We grab that photon using simple voltaic cells, and we convert that photon to electricity.
Well, how do you get it to go into a lower state of energy to be able to grab that photon?
The energy in the electron is maintained by the effect of the quantum vacuum field. Certain frequencies of the quantum vacuum field keep that electron going. If that electron were not constantly being replenished with energy from somewhere, it would lose its orbital energy because of angular acceleration or angular momentum. This is not allowed to happen. This was one of the things when the original concept of the Bohr atom came out. It was actually brought out by Rutherford. But when Bohr looked at it, one of the first things he said is the electron, because it's in a circular orbit, it's losing energy constantly and what's known as a lot more radiation. And so consequently, the concept that Rutherford came up with has to have a flaw in it somewhere, and that flaw is in that if there isn't something to keep that electron going, the electron is going to basically plunge into the heart of the atom. Matter as we know it can't exist. And this was one of the fundamental and formative discussions which eventually resulted in the whole theory of quantum mechanics and quantum physics.
So you're I'm sorry, keep going, but you're essentially grabbing the energy that the quantum energy field is giving, or vacuum field is giving back to the electron to keep it going.
Right. Basically, we're taking energy out of the electron's orbital and by passing it through the Casimir cavity, and we are then using that to create a bundle of energy, that is the photon. And then as the atom passes out of the cavity, it's re-exposed to the quantum vacuum field, and the electron is kicked back up to its ordinary normal
ground state. Then you put the energy that you took out back in to get it kicked up again, and then you take it out, more comes in, you take that out, and then you put the original back in, and it's just that constant process.
Precisely. And the amount of energy we capture per transit of an atom through a cavity, it's very small. It's on the order of 1 to 10 electron volts. And I generally point people towards 1 electron volt because I tend to be very conservative in my thinking. But it's a very tiny amount, but when you then multiply it by a lot of cavities and a lot of gas atoms that are going through these cavities, suddenly it becomes very significant. And we could be looking at, for example, in 1 square centimeter of cavity material, we could be looking at outputs possibly as high as 4 to 6 watts per square centimeter.
Wow. So how much, how big does it need to be a light bulb, for example?
Multiply 4 watts. You've got a 100-watt light bulb, and let's say 4 watts per square centimeter, that'd be 25 square centimeters to light a 100-watt light bulb.
Okay, so it would
we're not talking about...
Interesting. Okay.
And the design that we use obviously would not use just one passage through a Casimir cavity, but we would do multiple layers and thicknesses, and we would leverage the amount of output by increasing the number of square centimeters of pore space.
Oh, so you wouldn't, you could probably get, you might be able to get that 1/10 the size by increasing the number of things in there, so that you could do a light bulb with more of the size of a battery.
Absolutely. In fact, this is where we plan to take this technology. We would like to basically enter the marketplace with what would in effect be small power cells, which functionally perform like an ordinary battery, but which never require recharging or replacement.
And these are not dangerous. They're safe, and they're not dangerous at all by getting this energy out of the vacuum.
There is no way for this that we can see for it to have any sort of hazard associated with it. The atoms, as they go through the system, are unchanged, other than that they drop energy and we capture that energy. And there are no effects that we can think of that might make this dangerous in any way whatsoever.
So this is amazing. Okay, so how are you planning on using this technology? You're going to create batteries. You started explaining that, and I had to just talk about the dangerous thing, that it's not dangerous. But how are you going to do this? You're going to make batteries, and what kinds of products and things are you going to put it in?
Our focus is going to be initially just on small energy cells, which you could use in a flashlight, a laptop computer, a cell phone, possibly a small electric appliance, electric tools, anything where you needed mobile power that was available at an energy level that would be more keeping with what's associated with normal utilities.
So you mean no more cell phone, no more recharging our cell phone or plugging in our laptop every few hours? We could
go.
Wow, and my daughter could sit and watch her movies on the airplane, and we wouldn't have to worry about running out if we're on a long flight.
Precisely. And you know how many plot lines in Hollywood movies depend on a cell phone battery dying?
Yeah.
It's amazing. People live with a constant presence hanging over them of their cell phone going dead because the battery dies. And this is something that this technology has the potential to totally eliminate.
Wow, this is amazing. So
the other thing that it'll eliminate, which is a special favorite of mine, is it'll eliminate the need for extension cords.
Well, yeah, we got cords all over the place.
Yes.
Or lights outside.
I have a personal favorite of extension cords.
Now, is it going to be dim like a solar light is, or is it going to be nice and bright?
It's going to be what you want it, because the amount of energy depends directly on the amount of gas going through the cavities at any given moment. So the power cell is going to be designed to actually read the energy requirement of the load that's applied to it, and it will circulate gas through the cell at the rate necessary to provide that energy, and a small amount of energy over and above to maintain the operation of the circulating device in the cell. So basically, think of it as a membrane with hundreds and hundreds of millions of very tiny pores that gas is being allowed to pass through, and then recirculate over and over, and we're capturing the photons as they come off from the cavities and converting that to useful electricity.
Wow. Well, is this going to be a fortune? I mean, can you really, is this something that can be made at an economic level that the average Joe on the street will end up being able to purchase?
When we first started the program, because Casimir cavities are traditionally are made using gold as a wall material, we thought that they might be a bit on the pricey side. What we found, to our amazement, is that we can use a lot of materials as the walls of the Casimir cavity. And in fact, we have used a very simple, very inexpensive polymer membrane that's used in filtration in laboratories all over the world, something called a Wattman filter, and we've actually demonstrated the process with a Wattman filter. And this was crude, but it was a big surprise. We found that the materials of construction are going to be presumably very inexpensive, and we've recently latched onto some technology thanks to the advent of significant growth and development in nanolithography and nanoself-assembly technologies, whereby we can produce massive, large sheets of Casimir cavity materials at an incredibly low cost. So we envision the Jovian energy cells actually being not only price competitive with ordinary batteries today, but probably having a significant cost advantage over conventional batteries today.
Wow.
We see this as a very real possibility.
Well, this could be really... This definitely is a game changer for sure. So you're working with the University of Colorado Boulder on this. They hold the patents, right, on this technology. And how is your company working with them?
Preliminary investigation process was conducted in the quantum engineering laboratory at the University of Colorado by Dr. Garrett Modell, who is one of the inventors of the process. We've done several studies at the university at this point, and as part of our relationship with the university holds title to the original patent on the technology, and we have universal and global rights for marketing and use. And that is the nature of our relationship.
And the scientists that came up with it are actively involved in the company, correct?
Yes, they are.
Well, yes, I know
there are two inventors, Dr. Bernard Heisch, who is a retired astrophysicist and popular writer, and Dr. Garrett Modell, who is full professor at the University of Colorado.
Well, I know that a lot of the universities now are working with their science departments, their technology departments, and trying to monetize what their professors and their departments are coming up with to try to get it out to the marketplace. And I would assume this is more what Boulder is doing with you, one of those projects.
We are working independently of the university with respect to our commercialization efforts. We haven't asked the university to participate in that form. We would like to maintain a certain amount of independence for control of the technology, especially as our patent portfolio expands. We are just at the very edge, very cutting edge of a brand new field, and we envision probably well over 100 or more patents issuing from this technology as the basic research moves forward. This is an area that is going to open up many, many technological doors and we would like to have a considerable level of control over the technology.
Well, this will be incredible. So what are phase are you at right now? When do you think a product like this is going to be to market?
We are currently at a stage where we are raising funding now to complete the proof of concept. We have demonstrated the process in the laboratory on several occasions, we are now interested in taking that work and applying that work to engineering and construction of a larger unit, basically a benchtop scale device, which we intend to demonstrate And our objective is to demonstrate a device which operates at what is commonly referred to as overunity, i.e. the process produces more energy than is required for its own operation. In other words, it will not only be able to maintain its circulation of gas flow through the device, but it will also be able to supply additional energy to do useful work. And I'm thinking now in terms of lighting a light bulb, running an electric drill. I'm thinking that our benchtop unit will probably be in the 5 to 10, maybe higher watts in terms of its output.
You can start doing smaller devices. And what time frame are you thinking? Next year?
I think by late 2017 we can expect to have a working prototype of a Jovian energy cell that will be ready to convert to early commercialization.
And you have this all working in a lab, correct? Already? I mean, you've proven out this technology.
We have demonstrated the technology, but we have not proven it to our own satisfaction yet. We have demonstrated that the flow of gases through Casimir cavities definitely produces energy signals which have no other rational explanation other than that we're extracting them by the Jovian concept. But we now need to take that to the level where we can take it to any peer-reviewed group, or we can take it to any reputable journal, and we can publish. We need material which meets the criteria of the academic community, the scientific community, the business community, and the technical community to satisfy all of their questions and all of their requirements.
So what are the obstacles that you have now? What are you trying to, I mean, what do you foresee as your obstacles and what you're trying to do?
Biggest obstacle at the moment is we need to raise about $2.5 million to complete the proof of testing, proof of concept testing, and to then actually build and operate a unit that provides substantially more energy out than is required to operate it.
So if the United States doesn't do this, do you think there'll be other countries that'll end up beating us to this new development?
This unfortunately keeps me awake at nights, because nature abhors a vacuum, and if we don't do this, somebody else will. Fortunately, our initial patent is broad. And as we move forward, we're going to be expanding our patent portfolio dramatically. But ultimately, it would not be outside the scope of reasonableness to think of rogue nations who don't respect the international patent regulations the way we do to jump into the game and try to undercut us.
There's a lot of countries that don't acknowledge it.
That's correct. And that is a source of concern. But the U.S. market, the European market, those markets who do respect global patent treaties, they represent a large enough market that we're not concerned about the financial impact of it. But I really would like to get there first.
How incredible is this? Okay, so where can we see more about this and what you're doing, and how can, first of all, how can people get involved, and if they want to invest and learn more about your stuff and what's going on, how can they go about doing that?
Well, we have a website, www.jovion.com, www.jovion.com, and I would want to say one more time, Jovion, J-O-V-I-O-N, is the correct spelling of the company name. And this is certainly a place to learn more of the technical detail and a little bit about the management and the vision of the company. But if somebody is really interested in this, I would invite them to pick up the phone and call me personally. I'd be happy to talk to them, meet with them. I welcome email communications. I don't tweet, generally speaking, but I do an aggressive email correspondence, and I am very approachable. If somebody wants to call me and talk, I will talk to them. And I don't care if you know, I don't care if you're, you know, a universally recognized scientist or, you know, a layman from the street who just happens to be interested. I'm interested in talking with you. And,
you better be careful. You're going to get bombarded with phone calls. That's awesome. I'll have your phone number on my webpage and on my radio page, and I'll have that all up there for people. You can give it out now if you want.
Yes, and if they want to talk to me quickly and easily, the best thing to do is use my cell phone, which is area code 614-361-2162.
Well, before we stop, I want to ask you, where do you see this technology going? Like you said, there's going to be hundreds of patents and stuff. Where do you see this technology going, and how big of a market do you think this really is?
I wouldn't have a way of envisioning just the ultimate outreach of this thing. First of all, just thinking in terms of the immediate market that I'm focused on right now, which is simply drop-in replacements for ordinary batteries. The U.S. market is on the order of $18-19 billion presently for battery markets. The global battery market is about 130 some odd billion. So just the battery market alone is staggering. If we go beyond the battery market and if we start looking at applications outside the battery market, it just sort of then branches out and the sky's the limit. I don't want to be one of those guys who shouts and arm waves and, you know, oversell something. That's not the way I do things.
So you're walking cautiously right now because there's a huge amount of potential here, but you really got to get it to work on a small level with batteries and basic things and see what it really can do. See what the potential really is.
Right. If I can just simply put a battery in the hands of anybody who has a device and let them see it, let them use it, they'll understand the value of it. One of the great things about this technology is it does not appear to have any mechanism whereby you can weaponize it. It is not like some energy technologies which can be terribly destructive. And more than that, it has tremendous potential applications to provide cheap, inexpensive, very robust, portable energy for third world and developing nations. And
well, it sounds like it's
tremendous
safer.
Humanitarian impact.
Well, it sounds like it's safer than oil and, you know, or electricity even, because electricity can be dangerous, the flow of currents. And then with the poverty all over the world, it seems like it could be something really fantastic.
Yes, what we can do to help people in third world settings, there's just really no end of it. We could make possible heating, refrigeration, cooking, medical support, all of the things that currently are just not available in many areas.
Well, and I think getting a working battery and starting to get it out on, you know, flashlights and computers and cell phones and things would be just right. Just that would be a huge step forward.
That's where we want to go.
Well, you know what? Thank you so much for joining us. I'm just really excited. This is something that I'm going to be following quite a bit, and I'm definitely going to have your information up on my webpage and on my radio page, and hopefully people will take advantage of getting hold of you. And I'm sure the amount of money that you're asking for is just a drop in the bucket for some of these really, really wealthy people out there that need something really good to invest in. So
I think I can tell you that we have an opportunity that the right investor is going to just be absolutely excited beyond belief at the potential. And I'm looking forward to chatting with that person.
Okay, well, that sounds fantastic. And for now, you have a wonderful day.
So I hope you liked that interview as much as I liked doing it. I love that guy, and I love the fact he's doing this stuff. I am going to have him back on. He promised me another interview to give me a status as when they're ready to fully go. I want to bring more information on that project as soon as I possibly can to you. But for now, I want to remind everybody that you can get all my shows, sarahwestall.com. You should know that by now. And please support the show. I have this online shop. I just have a mug there. buy one for someone you love and help support the show. I'm testing it out. I'm going to have other products there as well. And hopefully it can be a win-win for people. They can buy things they like, and we can also fund the show. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.